You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with, resplendent in his casket, Palti casket, Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
I thought it was Ivan Gotti for a moment, but it's definitely Daniel Freeb. And unmistakably, in the bottom half of my screen, resplendent in his cycling podcast casket, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Happy New Year, chaps.
Happy New Year. Nippon.
Happy New Year. Is it a Happy New Year? It's just New Year.
Well, I mean, we've got to hope for better things, haven't we? 2021, enter the year with a little bit of optimism.
Yeah.
Thus far worst sequel since Teen Wolf 2? I don't know. 2021 following 2020. Not great so far.
Lockdown 3, you mean? Mm. We are very much locked down.
We had a call. We spoke, the three of us, yesterday, didn't we? And there was a historic moment in the course of that call where, Lionel, you confessed to feeling, was it optimistic at one point?
I did, yeah. A once-a-decade feeling for me, that, I think. But I've got to be optimistic, haven't we? Well, in terms of the cycling season, we've got to hope that it's less disrupted than 2020 was, and that the majority of events go ahead as planned. Maybe not back with full crowds. There may be some casualties, but we've got to be optimistic that we'll have a slightly more normal year than last year, haven't we? Let's enter the year on that upbeat note.
We do, and we are. And this is your safe space. I mean, we're not going to dwell on COVID here too much. Sorry to start off on that note. I'm going to immediately reverse back out of that cul-de-sac now, because we are in this episode. Well, it's a speculation episode. It's the one that Lionel's been looking forward to. This really plays to his strengths. But we're going to hear from some friends of the podcast.
This week we're doing the speculation episode. Next week, the optimism episode.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, I'm not in next week's episode, clearly.
No, that's true, actually. Yes, this week we're going to hear from Francois Thomazeau, Ian Boswell, Lizzie Banks, Ciro Scogna Emilio, Mitch Docker, a couple of left-field pundits as well, Harry Tanfield and Ben Lowe from Veloviewer. And we're also going to hear at the end from Hugh Carthy, who was in kind of festive holiday mode over the holiday season, and spoke to him, caught up with him, heard about his walks around Preston and his return to the Preston bus station and butter pie chatting there as well. So that's all coming a bit later on.
We've canvassed the aforementioned because we have basically abdicated all responsibility for speculation, haven't we? We are leaving it to others, friends and associates, acquaintances of the podcast, to give us their predictions, and we're going to pontificate about those predictions.
They're doing the heavy lifting. They're doing the heavy lifting, and we're just kind of sitting on for the ride. And, well, it is a new year, and there are going to be a few different things about the podcast this year. One or two little new features, which we'll maybe mention a bit later on. But one feature that will remain, I think, is the news roundup. Is it, Lionel?
Well, normally, yes, but this week, no news, Richard. Instead, we've got a new year, we've got a new season coming, lots of changes in the Men's World Tour, and you know how terrible I am at taking these changes on board. Often it takes me 18 months to remember that a team has changed its name or a rider has moved on to another team. So to help myself, really, I've made a list of 8 things that I need to remember this year, things that have changed. So first up, Orica Greenedge are no longer Mitchelton Scott. They're now going to be called Team Bike Exchange, taking the name from another of Jerry Ryan's companies. They're not riding Scott bikes anymore. They'll be on Bianchi's, so just commit that one to memory, Team Bike Exchange.
And Buckler are now Jumbo Visma.
I mean, if we could be here all day if we go that far back. But these are just things I need to commit to my memory. Second up.
And Lionel, hopefully when the racing does get going, you won't be confusing them, Bike Exchange, with the Flaminia Bianchi team of the 2010 vintage. The kit is almost identical.
Oh, heavens.
So can you remember that one? Made famous by Riccardo Ricco.
An early mention for Rico there. Excellent.
Some things never change.
Greg Van Avermaet now rides for AG2R Citroën. He's been at BMC and CCC, effectively the same team, for almost as long as we can remember, but he now rides for AG2R Citroën. Team Sunweb are now Team DSM. Mark Hershey, Tour Stage winner, of course, Flèche Wallonne winner, runner-up at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, bronze medalist at the World Championships. He's no longer with DSM. He's now at UAE Team Emirates. A real shock. Late transfer, that one, happening on January the 9th. We'll probably talk about that a bit later on in the episode. But a big-name rider making a surprise move to UAE Team Emirates. So I'll try and remember that one. Romain Bardet, though he does ride for Team DSM, he's been at AG2R his whole career. It will be most peculiar not seeing him in the traditional brown shorts. He's been with AG2R since 2012, so I must try and remember that one. EF Pro Cycling are now EF Education Nippo, taking on the sponsorship from a Japanese company, which has long been associated, Daniel, with one of the Italian teams, which usually gets a wild card at the Giro d'Italia, right?
Correct.
Another team name change, NTT Pro Cycling. I'd only just got used to calling them that rather than Dimension Data. Now they're going to be Team Quebeca Assos. Miguel Angel Lopez will not be riding in the baby blue of Astana. He'll be riding in the pale blue of Movistar. And Chris Froome is now riding for Israel Startup Nation. To be fair, I'll probably remember that one. And one other thing that's much easier this year is that the Yates brothers will be much easier to tell apart when they're racing in the same event, because Simon Yates is at Bike Exchange and Adam Yates is moving to Ineos Grenadiers. So I'm just mentally making a note of all those things. Listeners can keep a tally. Every time I get one wrong in the podcast, just top them up. And if anyone, a prize to the first person who spots me making an outdated mistake in the podcast. We'll send them a Cycling Podcast hat.
Don't know if we've got enough hats to be dishing them out to people who spot your mistakes, Lionel.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Well, it's a new year, but we are still sponsored by iWalker, and we're very grateful to them for their support. They are our title sponsor, have been since March last year. And if you run a small business or know somebody who runs a small business and would like to know a bit more about what iWalker can do for you, go to iwoca.co.uk, iwoca.co.uk. Well, I mentioned that we'd be hearing from some friends of the podcast, some of our colleagues, in the course of this episode. Let's hear from our first pundit now, Francois Thomazeau.
Right, guys, my predictions for 2021, it's a tricky one, of course. It's going to be a strange year again, obviously. We know that already. The year is only just started, and we know for sure that it's again going to be a strange year. But my prediction is to a kind of return to normal in terms of cycling racing and the World Tour. And my prediction is for a return of the old guard to the forefront of the sport. Because, I mean, we've been talking for the last 2 or 3 years of the young generation, you know, up-and-coming generation, kind of humbling the old guys, humbling the experienced riders. I mean, there's been talk of kind of a revolution in training, in you know, in spotting the young talent and everything, like, you know, everything that's been known in cycling for 120 years, you know, is finished, gone, and now everything is, you know, with guys like Egan Bernal or Tadej Pogacar, you know time is ripe for the young talent to win grand tours at the age of 20 and possibly to go ahead doing that for a long time. I've heard that those predictions before. Remember Ulrich, remember, you know, some of the talents that were supposed to shatter everything, to smash the bunch for once and for all. If we look back at 2020 and 2019, so far Egan Bernal has only won one Tour de France, and Tadej Pogacar has only won one Tour de France as well. As long as these guys have not won another Grand Tour, another Tour de France, it's pretty, you know, it's probably very premature to say that they're going to be the next big things in the world of cycling. We still have in the bunch guys, like Geraint Thomas has also won a Tour de France, but, you know, more probably Chris Froome, Tom Dumoulin, even Thibaut Pinot. I mean, you know, these guys, I really think the guys from the, you know, from the older generation, you know, virgin on 30 or sometimes virgin of 35, are far from finished, as Richie Porte showed last year. And my prediction for 2021 is that we'll probably not have, like we had this year, you know, young, up and coming, little known, well, riders winning Grand Tours. My bet is it's going to be, yeah, the revenge of the old guard. I'm sure these guys have been spurred into reaction. They want to show they're not finished, and they want to show the kids, you know, that the men are still around. So that's my prediction for 2021: the return of the old guard.
Well, Francois, they are fairly confident that the oldies will bounce back this year. I mean, that will be a very interesting thing to observe this year.
Whether slightly autobiographical prediction there from Francois.
I hope he's not listening. But I guess, you know, we're watching that with interest after the trend last year for young riders to perform very well, and whether that was a sort of aberration and anomaly, or whether it will continue this year. I mean, you know, the likes of Chris Froome, Alejandro Valverde, can we still mention him? He had a terrible season last year by his standards. But really, riders in their 30s, Greg Van Avermaet as well, will they return this year to the sort of level they were at a couple of years ago?
Well, I think everyone thinks that, don't they?
Do they?
Do they? Should we hear from someone who doesn't necessarily think that?
Good day to everyone over at the Cycling Podcast. Ian Boswell here, checking in from Northern Vermont, giving you my predictions for the 2021 season. I am going to go out on a limb. Well, maybe it's not that much of a limb, and say that I foresee the young riders once again really thriving come the start of the racing in 2021. I just think the fact that the calendar is so unpredictable, even now, sitting here in January, that these young riders, they don't have the pressure, they don't have the same expectations of kind of the traditional buildup to the season. You know, the years I spent at Team Sky with Froome, there's a very clear kind of roadmap of how you prepare for a Grand Tour, and you go to these races, and you go to altitude camp at this time, and they kind of, maybe more mentally than physically, need that kind of process to get ready for a Grand Tour. And I think that's why we've seen some younger riders really kind of rise up over the course of the last year, really, to prominence, is because they don't know what they need to prepare for a Grand Tour as far as, you know, the mental kind of process to run through. They're obviously training hard and working hard, but they don't have this set in stone way of how to prepare for a Grand Tour. So I think we're going to see more young riders once again atop podiums at the Grand Tour. It'll be interesting to see how everything shapes up over at UAE with the addition of Mark Hirschi. And hopefully we get to see Remco take part in his first Grand Tour. And although he's been at it for a couple years, he is one that I think will surprise, maybe not surprise us, but potentially surprise some of the Grand Tour favorites.
Well, chaps, this is why speculation is such a fool's errand, really. We don't know, do we? We don't know. Some young riders may do well, some old riders may do well, but that's me getting a splintery behind, sitting on the fence. I can
well,
see
as
Daniel.
As you usually point out at this time of the year as well, Lionel, traditionally, there are always young riders. There are always young riders on the scene.
There are. However, even I will acknowledge that there was a real trend over not just the last congested season, but really over the last couple of years of young riders making a real early splash. And we've speculated a lot in the podcast. I know, Daniel, one of your theories is, has the way riders train changed and made it more possible for younger riders, first of all, to know what's required to be at the highest level, because the data is all available to see what their olders and supposedly betters are doing in both training and racing? But also, does the more intense type of training benefit younger riders more and bring them up to the level? I mean, the received wisdom is that professional cycling, particularly the Grand Tours and the very long classics, are an endurance game. They suit older riders who've got miles on the clock, the diesels that take a bit of time to get going and are able to produce the power, late in races or at 2 weeks or in the final week of a Grand Tour. That's when the differences really are told. But I do wonder how much the congested season last year helped the younger riders, because it meant that they could hit peak form for a purple patch, which encompassed a lot of very big races. For example, Mark Hirschi had that great Tour de France, finally got his Tour stage win, and then won Flèche Wallonne, second at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, on the podium at the World Championships. And that was all because they were basically back-to-back races. Would he have been able to do that, having a big peak in the spring, up against other riders also trying to peak in the spring, then a big peak for the Tour, and then a big peak later on for the World Championships? It's speculative, of course, but I do wonder whether, as things go back to normal, the balance will swing back to the riders who are able to get up to a peak form, and maybe their peak form is slightly deeper, if you see what I mean. They can still deliver big results at 95%.
I thought what Ian said as well about a team like Ineos Grenadiers, for example, having such a dialed in method, whereby there are milestones on the way to the Tour de France, most obviously, and they are set in stone, set in concrete. I saw some comments from Chris Froome this week talking about his season has been sort of copy and pasted every year for many years, and he feels already at a new team that just the difference, the change in the routine is sort of refreshing for him. Of course, we'll see how his performances are, how his results are. Although I spoke to his team manager, Kjell Karlstrom, the other day, who says that he's very much heading in the right direction. He would say that, wouldn't he? But that will be one of the fascinating things to watch this year, how someone like Chris Froome does in a new environment. And I think the other thing last year that benefited young riders perhaps was having 3 or 4 months just to train and prepare, and not be sent to races to maybe do jobs for other riders. They could, and Larry Warbass made this point to us a few times in his diary that he kept for us, that, every rider was, there was a sort of democracy to every rider was able to just focus on themselves and prepare themselves without having the usual commitments that they might have if they're not a team leader. So, that maybe just upset the apple cart a bit last year as well.
I think that's a good point, Rich. There are these sort of dogmas that exist in professional cycling. One of those dogmas is the way the season is structured and the way teams structure their own season. And, right from the training camps in December and January, and they all sort of consolidate, cement this hierarchy which has existed in teams, for decades and generations, whereby the senior riders enjoy certain privileges, and the younger riders, for the first couple of years of their career, they're told that they have to spend the first few months of their first season or their first couple of years just watching what the older senior riders do and working for them. And I think that so many of those dogmas were swept away last year. So I think that's absolutely key. I mean, there are various points you can make, arguments you can make to argue that the oldies really have not gone away or never have gone away. I mean, one is that if you know, we talked about this wave of young talent last year and old riders underperforming, but who are we really talking about? We're talking about a handful of riders that didn't really show up last year for various, often extenuating circumstances. Geraint Thomas, for example, crashed in the Giro. Froome was still recovering from his injury in 2019 at the Dauphiné. So, you know, the ones that really didn't perform, Viviani, I suppose you would say, Valverde, Nibali. But there are also examples of older riders that did really well. And Richie Porte, I think Francois mentioned. Dan Martin had a very good Tour de France. Fuglsang won Tour of Lombardy, another 30-plus rider. And
did Dan Martin have a good Tour de France?
Good Tour of Spain. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tour of Spain? Hang on a minute. What's this?
And you know, it was such an unusual year, particularly, I think, for those older riders as well, many of whom have families. I think Alejandro Valverde became father for the fifth time last year. Different responsibilities to the younger guys. That probably played its part as well. And then Napalm, you know, you talk about endurance, and I think we've talked in the past about how over the course of a Grand Tour, riders' explosiveness tends to decrease, but their endurance will go up over the course of a Grand Tour. But the same applies really to a season and a career. Riders become less explosive and they become more resilient, and their endurance improves as the years go by. Well, last year really was all about explosiveness, in the sense that racing started sort of a month at most, if you're doing the Giro, sort of 2 months or a month and a half before your main objective of the season. And I think there was, you know, we heard about amazing power numbers last year. There was a lot of that kind of, you know, that good explosiveness around, and that was probably, you know, decisive in a lot of even the Grand Tours we talked about. I remember Adam Yates talking last year about the one thing that he noticed at the Tour de France last year that was different was how quickly the peloton was kind of sprinting out of corners, and it was just those very sort of small differences, but he really noticed just a difference in the level of kind of explosiveness in the bunch. And sure enough, you know, the younger riders who are naturally more explosive came to the fore. I suppose the counter argument to suggest that, you know, we did see a sort of permanent changing of the guard is that we always expect riders to sort of decline in a kind of linear, smooth fashion. And that is not the case for all of them. Sometimes they do just fall off a cliff, and it's just very difficult to predict where that cliff is. And, you know, you talk about guys like Nibali and Valverde. It could just be that the cliff was and was always going to be situated somewhere in that kind of 14, 15-month period between the end of racing in 2019 and their main objective, as it turned out, in 2020.
You mentioned Valverde. I mean, this is his 20th season as a professional rider. He's 40 years old. He'll be 41 at the end of April. I mean, he's so experienced, he can ride Grand Tours in his sleep. And if he's got a young baby, that may well come in handy. Just another one on one of the old-timers, and it does feel slightly strange to call Peter Sagan an old-timer, but just came to mind when you talked about sort of results falling off a cliff. I mean, Sagan, we assumed was going to be prolific, really, didn't we? We thought he was so versatile, he could win on lots of different terrain, tour stages by the handful. We thought that he would hoover up on the classics, particularly the monuments. And last year, just one stage of the Giro d'Italia to his name.
What a stage, though.
It was, of course.
What a win. I mean, absolutely. A win worth, you know, several bunch sprints, dare I say. I mean, we talk a lot about Sagan and his palmarès and his legacy and all the rest of it. When you actually look at the big races he's won, in Flanders, Roubaix, that stage of the Giro, a lot of them have been pretty special, you know, the way that he's gone out and won them, which probably counts for quite a lot, will count for quite a lot when we look back on his career. He's still capable of that. And it ties into your point about explosivity, Daniel, that I always said that I think Sagan will win Milan-San Remo when he's no longer a favourite to win Milan-San Remo. And it'll take an effort like that. It'll take a ride like that. At the Giro, he got fed up, kind of wait, you know, trying to win bunch sprints against Arnaud Démare. And this one, he just ripped up the kind of the rule book, as it were, and went out and, you know, just hunted that victory down and got it. It was phenomenal.
An interesting side discussion or something for another day. But when assessing somebody's legacy, what counts more, quality of victories or quantity?
Well, let's carry on with our predictions game, or other people's predictions. We're going to hear now from Lizzie Banks, who, of course, co-presents Service Course, our tech podcast with Tom Wally. And she's a professional rider as well, of course. And Ciro Scognamiglio of Gazzetta dello Sport.
My prediction for this year is that Elise Shabby, current Swiss national champion riding for Canyon-SRAM and my former teammate for the last 2 years, will get some surprising results. Unsurprising to me, because I know how strong she is, but I think that we'll see her on a podium or two this year. But I think that overall in the women's peloton, Trek Segafredo will continue to be dominant and be even more dominant than in 2020.
Dear listeners, ciao, and it's really a pleasure to be part of the first episode of our marvelous cycling podcast also in this 2021, hoping that there will be a year with more beaches than 2020, first of all. And about the new cycling season coming, I think the most important tendency could be, in my opinion, because also if it doesn't seem, I study a lot the bunch, and I think that there are three, at least maybe four teams that in which there will be really more victories and more strong riders than the other ones. I mean, so it will be a less democratic bunch in the sense that the few teams will have the majority of victories. In my opinion, Ineos, Jumbo Visma, UAE Emirates and Quick Step. In these four teams out of the 19th of the World Tour, I think that we'll see the majority of the most important victories of races, Grand Tours and monuments in 2021. Ciao, dear listeners. I hope to be again and soon part of my life, the cycling podcast.
Well, Lizzie Banks and Ciro Scognamiglio there. Lizzie predicting that Trek Segafredo will be even more dominant this year than they were last year. Yeah, they do look to be on a bit of a roll, but things are looking pretty competitive in women's cycling at the moment, with Annemiek van Vleuten joining Movistar, of course, and a new women's team, Jumbo-Visma, with Marianne Vos leading that team. She's kind of going back home because she was at Rabobank for many years, of course, and Jumbo-Visma are the latest incarnation of that. Just on that, we will actually, next week's podcast, should all being well, come from the Jumbo-Visma training camp in Alicante in southern Spain. Myself and Orla Chenoui are going there, and yeah, it should be a special from the camp with interviews with all the hitters. Primoz Roglic, Wout van Aert, Tom Dumoulin, Marianne Vos and others. So that's a bit of a special one for next week. It depends, of course, on us getting there, which nothing's guaranteed at the moment. I'm not even predicting that my flight will take me there on Saturday, but we'll see. Fingers crossed anyway. What did you make of Ciro's prediction that we will see a sort of a further emergence of superpowers, I guess, within cycling? Ineos, Jumbo-Visma, UAE Team Emirates and De Koninck Quick Step were the four teams that he thought would kind of become superpowers.
Well, if they're not already. The first thing to say is that Ciro's pronunciation of the word beaches is making me more nervous with every passing year and listen.
Yes, he does like his beaches.
Yes,
that's he doesn't like mountains. He likes beaches that are by the sea, yes, with sand and waves rolling in.
As regards his point about the emergence of a big five. Interesting. This is a big
five or big four?
A big five, wasn't it? It was a big four, big five.
Big four.
Big four. But then actually he did send me a footnote, which he didn't record. He said that Bora Hansgrohe could possibly infiltrate the big five, big four. This is a concept that's often... Well, it's used in English football, isn't it, Lionel? Do we talk about the big six now? Watford, Arsenal, Coventry, and in Italian football for many years there was this moniker was used, Le Sette Sorelle, the Seven Sisters, which were Inter, AC Milan, Roma, Lazio, Parma, Fiorentina, and Juventus. But just looking at the figures, chaps, just looking at some stats from last year, chaps, there isn't a clear gap at the top. So in terms of number of wins, we've got De Koning, UAE, Team Jumbo Visma, Bora Hansgrohe, and then FDJ, of course, or Groupama FDJ had that great season because Arnaud Démare, I think, picked up at least a dozen wins. And then come Ineos. But you would think... Given the way those teams have recruited in the closed season, there would be a bit of a consolidation of power in the hands of those top four or five. Particularly UAE have significantly strengthened. Of course, Pogacar, his status has risen since the Tour de France last year. And it is a bit of a cyclisme à deux vitesses, isn't it? Two-speed cycling, and we've talked about this for many years. Economically, that has been the case, that there have been four or five teams at the top of the World Tour that have become richer and richer, and there's another group that have really sort of struggled and scrapped to get by. Yeah,
I mean, we've got a relatively healthy situation where there are so many. You know, that's a quarter of the World Tour we're talking about being sharing the spoils among them. That's relatively healthy when you look at sporting leagues, and then you have teams like Groupama FDJ who punch above their weight probably in terms of budget and so on. But UAE Team Emirates, I mean, I think we were all taken by surprise with their recruitment of Mark Hershey. I mean, we don't know too many details about this yet, other than, you know, Hershey, who had this incredible year last year, was in the second year of a three-year contract last year with Sunweb. And obviously UAE have significantly upped his salary because we understand he was on a pretty low wage and it perhaps hadn't increased after his successes last year. So,
and he was on a three-year contract as well, Rich. So
a three-year contract, yeah.
Last year was his second year at Sunweb and he had another year to ride.
Yes, indeed. But very unusual to see a rider go... In those kind of circumstances, and a real coup for UAE Team Emirates. They'll have the vaccinated UAE Team Emirates, which again is another. It's just another sign almost of a team that is on a slightly different.
It's a bit of a flex, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is, because other teams. I spoke to a team doctor yesterday and. You know, other teams are very keen to vaccinate their riders, understandably. But it's not... The optics of it aren't necessarily great when so few people have been vaccinated. But the practicalities of it are difficult as well.
Yeah, I mean, the optics aren't great, but I suppose we should also point out that the team is really set up and makes no bones about being a sort of propaganda organ for the UAE. And they've used the vaccination. If you watched last week, the way it was kind of filmed, the way it was promoted, they are very much the standard bearers or the flag bearers, that team for the country. And this is, they're promoting the UAE's vaccination effort and promoting the UAE as a sort of, I wouldn't say forward looking, but financially and economically powerful nation.
Just on the optics, Daniel, of UAE Team Emirates vaccinating their riders, I mean, I'm conflicted about this because on the one hand, I get what you're saying, you know, the general population having to wait, health workers, supermarket workers, other key workers, being leapfrogged perhaps in the queue by professional sports people. But on the other hand, I can see the argument that if for the entertainment of a significant number of people we're expecting professional sport to go on, is it a good idea to vaccinate the people who are going to be travelling around putting themselves at perhaps increased risk for the, you know, their own enrichment, of course, they're fulfilling their jobs, but also for the entertainment of others. So I'm kind of, it's not an easy one for me that I can see both sides of it. The unfortunate bit is just, you know, the vaccine doesn't prevent people from passing on the virus. So, you know, it's not like it's putting them in bubbles to protect other people. But I can see that, you know, the wisdom of having the World Tour riders vaccinated is that I can't really see much of an argument against that. A quick clarifications corner on that point. The scientific community does not yet know whether the vaccine will also prevent transmission as well as offer immunity.
And I suppose, Lionel, if it's deemed to be in the interest of a country to advocate vaccination and, you know, they want as high a proportion of their population as possible to be vaccinated, then having a group of young athletes who are very, you know, obviously conscious of their physical health and rely on their physical health for their well-being, having, you know, them seen to be vaccinated is quite a powerful message to the rest of the population, people who might be hesitating to get vaccinated.
I wonder if Israel Startup Nation will be not far behind, because they've you know been very prolific in vaccinating their population, and the team serves a similar purpose, doesn't it?
Indeed. Just on the point about Mark Hershey and his surprise transfer to UAE Team Emirates, I must admit I did breathe a sigh of relief that he wasn't going to Ineos Grenadiers, because, you know, that would have felt like a real concentration of power, another flex of a significant financial muscle to accumulate all of the talent in one team. So certainly for the health of the World Tour, having great young riders spread across different teams, and also strengthening UAE Team Emirates and making them part of the Big Four or Big Five, however we look at it. On the subject of the Big Four or Big Five teams, I remember being quite captivated by the Big Four riders at the Tour de France: Froome, Nibali, Contador and
Quintana,
that's it. Thanks, Rick. And of course, Oleg Tinkoff offered the $1 million bonus if somebody won all three Grand Tours. And, you know, that stirred up a bit of rivalry between those four, from our point of view anyway, as sort of spectators from a bit of a distance. So I'd certainly think if, you know, the fact that the three Grand Tours were won by three teams who have strength in depth to challenge for the Grand Tours again, and then factoring in even Chris Froome, if he can get back to some sort of level to be competitive in quite an eclectic looking Israel Startup Nation team, you know, I think that's all for the good of the sport. And then De Koenig Quickstep, of course, the great unknown, how Remco Evenepoel comes back from his crash and what sort of impact he makes when he finally rides a Grand Tour. But definitely feels like a reasonably healthy landscape at the moment. It isn't just one team and, you know, 16 or 17 others making up the numbers. And the pressure is on the other teams, I think, to make the most of their resources. And perhaps they can't hoover up the quantity of wins, but they could maybe take a leaf out of Team Sunweb's approach to the Tour de France and other races last summer and, you know, punch a bit above their weight.
And another aspect to this that struck me, chaps, just looking at those teams and considering where the money's coming from, this might be the start of a separation that we see as the pandemic progresses and hopefully ends. In terms of, well, the activities of the sponsors, because these, if you think of De Koenig Quickstep, well, that's two home improvement companies effectively, and Bora Hansgrohe the same, and then Jumbo Visma, well, Jumbo are a big supermarket chain, aren't they? And I think I'm right in saying that those are businesses that have done relatively well out of the pandemic. I think we feared when the pandemic started last March that there would be probably more economic carnage or more teams being lost and going bust than has actually been the case. But there is maybe a little bit of separation starting between sponsors that, you know, have either stayed afloat or actually, you know, done better than would ordinarily have been the case. And those businesses in industries like travel and, well, EF Pro Cycling, I mean, that's almost a travel company, isn't it? You know, student exchanges and companies like that, that I think have found things a little bit more difficult. And then the other thing that I was going to mention later, another sort of prediction for next year and the year after, is just the increasing financial power of the cycling, the bike industry. And that might start to have an effect on professional cycling next 2 or 3 years as well, because we're no longer, you know, we're not talking about artisan Italian frame builders anymore. We're talking about huge multinational corporations who, with the increasing popularity of e-bikes as well, are becoming very, very big companies with considerable financial resources.
And just lastly, one other trend that we may see as the sort of economic shakedown affects the World Tour, maybe the Mark Hirschi transfer will be, well, it's not the first transfer where a rider has left a team whilst under contract, but maybe there'll be a shifting in the way that the transfer market works as well. We don't know any of the details, but we have to assume that, do we have to assume? You would think that there would have been something in it for the management company that owns Team DSM. They couldn't just have given away one of their prize assets, even if an agent had managed to demonstrate that he was being, you know, significantly underpaid according to his market worth. I mean, his market worth shot up dramatically, making it hard for DSM to keep hold of him. But if he was under contract, that contract would have had to have been negotiated to a close with perhaps some financial compensation. Who knows? We may see more of that kind of transfer. What we don't have in cycling is the sort of transfer speculation that there is in football, and the transfer fees don't tend to make it out into the public domain.
Well, Lionel, this was something else that I was going to mention for 2021. I think we are going to see another step in that direction, not least because over the last 3 or 4 years, slowly we've seen teams, and certain teams, start to sign longer and longer contracts with their prize assets. So they're no longer 2-year contracts, are no longer universal. Now we sometimes get 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And inevitably, in the course of those contracts, riders find that they don't, you know, they can't do the races they want to do, or they're sort of gazumped by superior riders that come along. And, you know, you get unhappy riders that do want to break their contract. And when you also factor in, I don't know if you guys saw last week that Corso Sports, the management agency, have started a partnership with Jorge Mendes, the famous football super agents company. And at the moment, I think it's on a very, very small scale, and it's only a couple of Portuguese riders are involved. But that's maybe also just a sort of nod in that direction as well. I know I saw some comments from Mark Madio yesterday about Jorge Mendes possibly becoming more involved in cycling, and he's certainly not very enamoured with that idea. But we've talked quite a lot in the last year or two about cycling already having its own super agent, Mr. Cuadro, who wields a lot of influence as well.
Wow. Well, look out for Cristiano Ronaldo joining Team DSM at some
Messi's,
point.
Messi's
soon.
Out of contract.
Messi to Ineos. Shall we hear briefly from Mitch Docker with his prediction for 2021?
G'day guys, it's Mitch Docker here, host of Life in the Peloton and pro rider for EF Nippo Pro Cycling Team. My predictions for 2021 are that Australia is going to retain the Ashes, baby. Oh yeah, it's the year of the Ashes and Australia's looking good. Guys, stay tuned for the first episode of Life in the Peloton coming up. I've got a good friend of mine on the podcast, Heinrich Hausler. That'll be out on the 20th of January. So until then, guys, cheers.
Right, so who was in charge of briefing Mitch Docker about this?
Well, I said his prediction could be on absolutely anything. I didn't specify it had to be about cycling, to be fair.
Well, I hope life in the peloton remains on track. Actually, I'm really looking forward to his first one. Henrik Hausler is a fascinating guy. So I'm sure that'll be a really interesting interview, which will be out next week. Lionel,
that's
right.
Life in the Peloton returns next week. Mitch is training hard, I think, for the 2021 season, maybe looking ahead to the end of the season and the Ashes. Cricket's a game that... is it popular in Scotland, Richard? I think I've done this one before.
In parts.
England versus Australia. No other nations can take part in the Ashes, and just makes me think, you know, how multinational cycling is. I mean, obviously, other countries can play cricket, but they just can't take part in.
They just
the
don't want to.
There was some good. There was some good sledging caught on camera. Australia are playing India at the moment, and the Australian wicketkeeper Tim Payne. We don't really have enough sledging in cycling, do we? It's not.
Well, funny you should say that, Daniel. Just today, I was reading an interview with Peter Sagan where he was complaining about Wout van Aert at the Tour de France last year, the stage where Sagan used his head on van Aert, and Sagan was relegated to last, and van Aert was punished as well for gesturing angrily with one of his fingers in Sagan. But Sagan said that he should have been relegated for what he said to him. And I wonder what he said. Something was said that Sagan is still quite angry about, it seems.
One example of sledging from cycling that leaps to mind, if anyone wants to go back and listen to the first episode of Kilometre Zero from the Tour de France last year, on the Col d'Ez, the famous climb from Paris-Nice, Bradley Wiggins told a story about sledging Cadel Evans during the 2009 Tour de France.
We should probably explain what sledging is. It's not descending a mountain on a
tea tray.
No. Sledging is sort of trash talking, is what the Americans call it. You know, verbally abusing in the course of a sporting competition.
You've got to assume that there's going to be sledging in the peloton. 180 riders all have too much to say.
You see, this is where I nearly called up our friend Graham Bartlett, the head of Velon, today to get his prediction for 2021. But this is where Velon could really come into their own, isn't it? Because they, of course, have the keys to the kingdom as far as sledging is concerned. They have all the GoPro footage from in the peloton.
Well, this is a nice segue, actually, into one of the new features that we want to launch in 2021. When I say we, I mean I don't detect much enthusiasm for this from Lionel or Daniel. But I listen to a Sunday morning radio program called Broadcasting House on Radio 4. And one of their features, which I really enjoy, is called Slow Radio. And listeners send in clips of audio, which can be anything at all, and they play a section of this, and it's just, it can transport you somewhere else. And one thing I think about cycling is that we sometimes don't appreciate or even hear the sounds of cycling enough, either racing or training or riding your bike, anything at all. So we'll play, maybe not next week, because we'll be at Jumbo Visma, but the following week we'll play a first clip of Slow Radio. It might be something that I record, but we want your submissions. So send in any sound at all from your own cycling. We'll try and get pros to record stuff as well this year. Send it in and we'll play it in the episode. contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
But just on Mitch's point, looking forward to the Ashes and thinking that Australia will win, I can't really argue with that, Mitch. I think Australia probably will win the Ashes. But in cycling's very own Ashes, you've got the British Ineos Grenadiers versus the Australian Team Bike Exchange. Got it right first time.
Well done.
And we've got the Yates brothers on opposing sides in the very own cycling Ashes. The Yates brothers, who will come out on top between Simon and Adam? Who will have the better year now that they're on different teams and could presumably come up against one another in similar objectives this year for the first time? When they've been in the same races before, you know, there's always been a plan who's going for stages or who's going for the GC or what have you. It'll be really interesting to see this year if they actually go head-to-head as rivals.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
It gives me great pleasure to say thank you very much again to Science in Sport, who are back. They are our longest standing sponsor. They've been with us since the Giro in 2016. And they're huge supporters of ours, and their support of us is massively appreciated. If you want 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout. And if you also have a nutrition question that you want to send in to James Morton of Science in Sport, email us contact@thecyclingpodcast.com and we'll put more of your questions to him quite soon. A couple of little bits and pieces before we move on to a couple more predictions. Our latest friend special, fan club special, with guest editor Nigel Manson, listening to the podcast, That's out for friends of the podcast. Thank you very much indeed, everyone who's signed up as a friend of the podcast over the last few weeks. Again, that your support is much appreciated, and there's lots to come for friends of the podcast. I'm working on a couple of specials at the moment. Lionel, I think you've got one on the boil as well.
They might have three. They might have three on the boil at the moment, actually, wow. Richard. I mean,
wow. No need to show off. That's all coming. And if you want to sign up as a friend of the Cycling Podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. If you sign up as a good friend for either a £50 or a £100 donation, you will get a casquette as modelled currently by Lionel, or a beautiful Cycling Podcast tea towel, which I think he's maybe reaching for now. No, he's not. He's just taking his hat off. Anyway, they will be posted out over the next few weeks, or certainly next month or so. So you will get them in the post.
Yeah, just on that, Rich, we will be emailing everyone who is a best friend of the podcast or good friend of the podcast at the end of January to gather up delivery addresses so that we can send out the caps and tea towels, and we anticipate those being dispatched sometime in February. So look out for an email from us towards the end of this month, and then we will start dispatching as soon as we can in February.
Moving on, shall we hear from a couple of more people with their predictions for 2021? Let's hear from Harry Tanfield, who's signed for Quebec at Assos, and Ben Lowe of Veloviewer.
I'm Harry Tanfield, and I ride for Quebec at Assos. On the racing front, in terms of what might be getting developed, I guess, for this year, new technologies and things like that, I guess, in the peloton. Obviously, we've seen a few, some crazy handlebar setups coming out of the... I know Jan Willem van Schepp, his handlebars that he made, which I don't think they're illegal, but they're I don't know if the UCI has a minimum handlebar width limit, but there might be one soon, or something to do with the specification, I don't know, but I think that obviously pushing the aero front with those crazy handlebars that Jan Willem has developed, they look quite comfortable, one mindset, but yeah, pretty crazy. I know that Dan Bingham in England, he's got himself lined up with some really narrow, I think they're track handlebars that he's adapted for the road, with a bit of modification, and these super narrow bars that he can get a really nice position on, which is what he's wanting to do for all these road race victories that he's going to take in 2021, with his mad aero position. It's what he's claiming anyway. Yeah, so I think that on that front, I think it'd be quite interesting to see where that goes, whether the UCI has to step in, I don't know, but I'd imagine it would just get stamped on, like, it's in the interest of safety and all that kind of thing. But, I mean, people would argue against it, but I think that that's probably what's going to happen.
Ben Lowe, the creator of Veloviewer here. My prediction for the 2021 season is that there will be an increased need for the teams to prepare for races digitally rather than doing physical recons, where they would usually ride or drive the course prior to the race. A combination of travel restrictions for DSs and riders, combined with the high chance of races having to make late changes to the routes, mean that teams will need to rely more heavily on platforms like Veloviewer to help them with their planning. The majority of the teams now have these tools, so it will be interesting to see how the staff and riders across the teams make best use of them.
Well, Ben Lowe of Veloviewer there, making the stunning prediction that 2021 will be a huge year for Veloviewer. interesting prediction there from Ben, I thought, because we did hear that quite a lot in 2020, that riders had not been able to do recons, and there were numerous occasions where they were surprised, slightly upset, and blindsided by last-minute tweaks to routes. And of course the difficulty is still that, you know, it's very much a movable feast, the calendar in 2021, isn't it? I wouldn't be terribly confident. I mean, I'm quite confident about most of the major races taking place, but I'm not exactly sure that they will all take place where they're supposed to.
What about that's a good point. The Tour de France is definitely going to happen in France.
One would hope so.
What about Harry's prediction about these ever narrower bars on road bikes? How do we feel about that? I'm pretty anti it.
Why?
it just on aesthetic grounds. I'm a bit of a traditionalist. I like the traditional bike. I was looking in the UCI rules because Harry mentioned the UCI rules, and there aren't. There doesn't seem to be a minimum width. There's a maximum width of 50 centimeters, but it doesn't appear to be a minimum width stipulated. It just says the bicycle should have handlebars which allow it to be ridden and maneuvered in any circumstances and in complete safety. And it does say only the traditional type of handlebars may be used. So there's a bit of leeway there, but I think if there must be a point at which very narrow bars become unsafe, I would think.
You would think so, Rich, although obviously, you know, you have more experience of elite cycling than us. But yeah, I can...
I don't know why that's funny.
The Harry mentioned there, it's a Dutch company called Speco, I think they're manufacturing a very eye-catching bar, which is 32 centimetres on the top, and it's got a sort of flare, so the drops go out to 37 centimetres between the two ends of the drops. And I think you mentioned Dan Bigham there, who's experimenting with something similar in UK racing. But I think increasingly this is where teams are trying to make gains with equipment. That's where the battle is being fought on the aerodynamic front. I mean, Harry himself had numerous conversations with him at the Vuelta last year about various equipment that other teams were using, and how, you know, even on descents, it's very noticeable to riders now that certain other riders in other teams, same weight, are simply, you know, able to ride away from them because of increased or improved aerodynamics. And I think, you know, with the reliance now on power meters, riders are more and more aware of where other teams and riders are gaining through aerodynamics. But it does make me think as well of the old Spinaches, which had a brief but very well, very lucrative
shelf life.
Shelf life in the mid 1990s. I think they were released in 1994 by the Cinelli company, and they lasted, well, it was 1997 when the UCI outlawed them. The UCI were concerned in 1997 that racing was getting faster and faster, and they decided that it was because of Spinaches, which is one interesting take. I'm sure they were having an effect. But Cinelli sold about, I read the other day, around 800,000 of these between 1994 and...
From memory, they were about 30 quid a pop. I got a set, but Harry's experience at the Vuelta of watching riders ride away from him going downhill, very similar to my experience at the Tour de France, actually, going out with Lionel. I never put it down to aerodynamics of Lionel.
No, pudding power.
No, it wasn't down to Spinaci, of course, meant spinach. It wasn't down to spinach. It was probably down to Cassoulet.
Cream spinach.
I don't know if you guys remember any particular instance in around that time, 1996, 97. I think there were a number of crashes, fairly maybe high-profile incidents in races, which was supposedly caused by spinach.
Yeah.
There was certainly one in the Championship of Zurich. Stefan Urlo was sort of leading it out for Davide Rebellin, I think was his teammate, who won the race for Française des Jeux, and he was leading it out in his spinaches, and there were numerous crashes behind. And I think that the debate was sort of stirred up after that race. But I had the ITM version, the Tiramisu they were called.
I mean, they were no more dangerous than the current vogue for having your hands sort of hanging off the handlebars in front. You talked about Mark Hershey a bit. There was a question in Service Course in the episode just before Christmas about the position that he adopted with his computer, using that as, like Spinaches, really. And of course, I think the more dangerous position is the way that riders descend now on the top tube. The whole balance of the bike is wrong. And the same argument for, you know, it's not really with Spinaches, it's about how easily you could reach your brakes. You know, if you're reaching for your brakes, it's kind of already too late in a lot of crashes. But,
well, Cinelli at the time did commission a slightly dubious, I must say, study from a university in Milan, which the finding of which was that it took exactly the same time to reach brake levers and pull the brakes with Spinacci without Spinacci, but I don't really see how that's possible.
Yeah.
But we will probably talk a lot about safety again in 2021. Of course,
who'd have thought that in our 2021 preview episode we'd be talking about Spinacci's? Yeah.
But
how counterintuitive.
We always talk in terms of safety. We always talk about the negatives, you know, when crashes and major incidents do happen. But it went largely unnoticed, uncommented on the Vuelta last year. There were almost no crashes. And I wonder whether the effect of disc brakes is starting to be reflected in sort of a lower incidence of crashes.
Oh, some people will not be happy about that, but I would anecdotally agree that that might be the case because they're just better.
Or is it because there's not as much disparity between, you know, that more riders are on disc brakes, so there isn't that gap in braking power between the riders who are on discs and
exactly.
The riders who are on clinchers. I mean, that was all. Yep. That was one of the main the idea that the discs might slice people's legs open was the big fear when it came to the safety of disc brakes in crashes, that they might be more dangerous. But that doesn't seem to be borne out at all, does it, so far? And we've got enough evidence to suggest that that's not an issue. But yeah, interesting.
Does that conclude the predictions from our pundits, Rich?
It
no
does.
Predictions.
Got anything for us, Daniel? No,
well, I was having a bit of a brainstorm. I don't know if you chaps have got anything any phenomena or trends that you think we'll see in 2021. I noted a few things down. So on the 1st of January, the UCI's anti-doping operational activities passed from the CADF to the International Testing Agency. I predict some beef on that front in the next 2 or 3 months. Hopefully nothing that compromises the credibility of races, but much like another fairly seismic transition that happened on the 1st of January that we're not very happy about, but we shouldn't talk about politics. Crossover stars, riders possibly doing a ROG. A few candidates for this 2021: Anton Pautzer, Bora, that he was a ski mountaineer. He's having a go at professional cycling this year. Javier Romo of Astana, he's coming from triathlon. And Marti Vigo at Androni, who was competed in the Olympics in cross-country skiing in 2018. And he's debuting with Gianni Tavia this year. So that could be an interesting one to follow. Could this be the year when we start talking about young Italians in the same way that I used to drone on about young Frenchmen a few years ago? I see the France's star, I think, is on the wane slightly in terms of their kind of golden generation is maybe slightly just sort of sliding past its peak at the moment. A few good Italians, very young, sort of first and second year. Aliotti at Bora, Bagioli at De Koenig, Dainese at Sunweb, Tiberi at Trek, Sobrero at Astana, look out for them. Crosswinds playing a bigger role in races continuing to play a big role in races. I think that race organizers are looking for them more and more, Grand Tour organizers. We heard from Ben Lowe earlier, Velo Viewer. I think that, you know, the teams have a huge amount of information now about, you know, weather forecasts and where crosswinds are likely to take place. And we've seen year after year, certainly in recent times, what a huge effect they can have on general classification. I don't like them. I've made my position clear on crosswinds. I think they should be banned because they make me sad. But other people don't mind them. Big disparities in the vaccine rollout across countries are going to create problems. I think there are going to be some countries where the calendar is intact and maintained and races can be ridden, and other countries where it might be tricky, and that's going to cause some problems, I think. Final thing, chaps, lead out trains, or two more things actually, just on the sort of tactics of racing. Lead out trains becoming a bit more like a team sprint. There were just hints of this last year at the Tour de France. There were some lead outs that Sunweb did where, you know, traditionally we've always thought that teams, you know, they need three guys left maybe in the last kilometer, three, possibly four. There were times last year at the Tour de France where Sunweb sort of surged to the front with five guys in the last kilometer, and they were doing short turns on the front, and it was quite impressive. Difficult to pull off, difficult to choreograph in every bunch sprint, but I think I can see sprinting moving in that direction. Last thing, chaps, Dave Brailsford has made a lot about how Ineos are going to ride more with kind of more sort of individual panache, and they're going to be more individual focused on in 2021. Very intrigued to see how that's going to manifest itself. I don't know about you guys, but I sometimes disappoints me that there aren't more sort of tactical paradigm shifts in professional cycling, that, you know, we don't see teams come up with genuinely innovative, easily sort of clearly identifiable tactics that they kind of put into practice and you can really put a name on.
Well, I mean, I guess Sunweb last year, you mentioned their leadouts, but also just the way they rode. Well, a couple from me, not predictions as such, but Movistar had a terrible year last year. Curious to see how Superman gets on there. And also, Gregor Mühlberger is a very good signing for them, I think. Ivan Garcia Cortina as well, a very talented young rider who seems to have plateaued a little bit, but definitely got a lot of talent. I sent some footage at the weekend of Movistar at Madrid Airport. They were stuck there, some of them, on their way to training camp, and Superman was one of the riders who apparently had to sleep on the floor with his head on his bike box. So not a great start to his Movistar career, but should pick up. And they certainly look a lot stronger than last year. And I had another... Well, my other prediction is less positive, but I do feel that we're seeing a lot of sports now, problems of breaches of COVID protocol really causing huge problems. And it's kind of amazing that there were so few cases. Cycling kind of happened in a window last year where the threat seemed to have receded. It's certainly back with a vengeance. And, you know, a rider could put out an entire team, or certainly a chunk of an entire team, quite easily, it seems to me, the way that teams are and the way they operate together. There are some teams who are already operating bubbles now, you know, with different riders in different parts, and other teams have got all their riders together. I'm sure we'll see. Some teams affected. Unfortunately,
you sound like you might have some intel
COVID
there, Richard.
Nothing specific, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if some teams' plans were quite seriously compromised by just one rider. In last season, there was just one case that we know of a rider breaching protocol. Michael Storer went out to buy a bottle of shampoo. But I think everybody's a bit more complacent now, aren't they? Everybody seems to be more complacent, and I think the chances of breaches are probably greater. Well, it's Richard from the future here, and subsequent to recording this episode, some news came to light. I mentioned Superman's night at Madrid Airport not being the perfect start to his Movistar career, and then I mentioned possible breaches of COVID protocol this year, and these two stories are connected because Superman's year went from bad to worse when, on finally arriving at the Movistar training camp, he tested positive for COVID. He had tested negative before traveling to Europe from Colombia, and then apparently came into contact with someone who had COVID. Then he flew to Europe and came into contact himself with some but not all of his new Movistar teammates. So a terrible start to the year for Lopez and Movistar, but hopefully no one is too unwell and they all make a full recovery.
Yeah, I'm not sure, compared to a sport like football where there have been a number of high-profile breaches with parties and, you know, gatherings to play poker and all of that kind of thing.
Yeah, No,
but I think, you know, a guy going out to buy some shampoo, yeah, okay, that's breaching the protocol. And maybe that's the point. Yeah, you're just in a fairly innocent, low-key way.
Exactly.
Because they are all living in such close proximity, aren't they? You know, football teams are required to travel on multiple team buses, for example, to away matches here in the UK. I mean, that's not something that's really possible in cycling. Once they're in their bubble, they've just got to hope that the virus stays out. But I think the evidence of last year was that the bubbles were pretty tight. I mean, the Giro with Mitchelton Scott and Jumbo-Visma having to go home, you know, that was unfortunate, but
That'll be another one, actually. Just another one to add to the list. Look out for reprisals from RCS on, well, two groups of people, possibly Jumbo Visma, because they're very aggrieved at how Jumbo Visma left the Giro. And also the Milan San Remo route, RCS were very unhappy at the way local authorities along the Mediterranean coast there, how they didn't want the race effectively in August, and they had to change the route as a result. And I think we might see the same route as we saw in 2020 in 2021.
Well, this is the only speculation that I'm prepared to engage in this year. That's it. I've indulged the speculation. We'll see how it all unfolds, won't we?
We will. Let's hear a little bit from Hugh Carthy, who, of course, had his breakthrough Grand Tour performance, really, at the Vuelta last year. He finished third in the end. And I caught up with him over the festive period. Here he is at home in Preston.
In fairness, I finished quite late the past few years anyway. I've done the race in China every year for the past three seasons. So I've always been finishing right at the end of October. So for me, it's not really changed much. I usually start training on the 1st of December properly, or the last week of November, the latest. But now I've just, at a similar time, I started training, I don't know, about just over a week. So not too different, really. I had three solid weeks off. I didn't do any sport, nothing. I didn't move. And then, yeah, just slowly getting back into it. But it's quite nice in a way. I've finished earlier in the season a few times in the past, and you get to November time, people, end of October, people still racing. You've had a month off already, thinking, bloody hell, I've got a long winter ahead of me. But sometimes it's quite nice to finish late, have a kind of compact off season, like just have the correct amount of time off, and you don't really lose too much fitness. And it feels easy after a week or so of riding. You feel like you're back where you should be, rather than you have 4 weeks off proper, then you kind of tinker around for a bit and messing around, and then it gets to the mid-November, you think, bloody, I've lost a lot more fitness than I expected.
How do you reflect on what happened in Spain? I mean, finishing on the podium, you know, winning that stage, you must look back on it with real sense of satisfaction.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the result that I knew I was capable of, a podium, but I don't know. I knew I was capable of getting a top five Grand Tour at some point, whether it was this year, next year, or somewhere along the line. I definitely knew it was possible. But for it to happen this year in such a strange year, it was it was a welcome end to the year, I think, for myself and the team as well. It was it rounded everything off quite nicely for this year.
Was it maybe the Giro last year that gave you that confidence? Because you rode very well there, very aggressively and quite consistently over the 3 weeks. Was that the one you think that maybe sort of set off a light bulb in your head, or did you think that even before then?
Yeah, I think before that, before the Giro last year, I think the winter, so the end of 2018, I said to the team I'd like to have a stab at the top 10 in a Grand Tour Giro or something. And the team were a bit more sort of, it wasn't that they didn't think I could do it, I just thought it'd better to sort of go to one without any expectation and see how it goes, rather than setting my sights on it from December and then stressing about it all year, and then everything sort of going wrong in the event, or if something did go wrong, I'd put so much effort into it and emotion into it that you do sort of everything would backfire. But so I think they wanted to hold me back from that a little bit, but I turned up at the Giro sort of with one eye on it and the other eye thinking, oh well, if I don't do it then whatever. But yeah, that's how it went last season, and that sort of backed up. I think I had a day where I sort of didn't really, I lost quite a bit of time, but apart from that day, I think I was pretty consistent, like you say. So yeah, I knew then that if I could eliminate that bad day and find other days where I could gain time, then I knew a top five. I knew the way I was feeling and the people I was riding alongside. I knew that I was sort of top five material. The time trials didn't really put me off, despite what people think of my time trial and ability. They didn't really put me off. So I knew that I could hold my own there, hold my own in the mountains, and all I need to do is just be more consistent. I think now to get to sort of, it's just building consistency, even more consistency. So just having these good results riding alongside these people, featuring the races every race, rather than just doing it once or twice a season, we've got to be doing it sort of week in, week out. But yeah, no, I don't really feel fazed by it. It's only bike race at the end of the day. It's you're going up a hill or whatever, you're closing something down. It's not that difficult. It's a hard physical effort. Don't get me wrong, but when I'm feeling good and my legs are good, I feel sort of unbeatable. Obviously, I'm not unbeatable, but you sort of carry that mentality and carry that feeling, that general feeling where you think, well, I can beat him. And these attacks, as you say, when you're feeling great, they don't feel that hard. The multi-roller that day, my legs felt great, and you don't really think that you're riding up one of the hardest climbs in the world. And the same this year in the Angliru, and other day, plenty of days like that during the Vuelta this year where you get back to the bus and people are complaining, say, not complaining, but people saying, oh, that was a horrible stage, or that climb was horrible. And you're thinking, well, I didn't think it was that bad. I thought it was all right. But that's not because, I don't know, I've been on the opposite foot with races over the years, and you're thinking, bloody hell, what have I got to do to be at the front? And you can't keep at the front to save your life. And other people seem to be just floating around there. I think that's just how the form works. And, I think for me going forward now, it's just being able to do that consistently. And I think that becomes a bit easier as well now that the team have got more faith in me. There's a couple of riders departed from the team, so it gives me a little bit more space in the team now. I've got my shot now.
It sounds like you almost put yourself in a box and then, you know, just managed to recover sort of in time to hit a kind of sweet spot of form at the Vuelta. Is that, you know, will you try and replicate that maybe before a Grand Tour next year?
Yeah, it's something that we talked about. Maybe not take it to the extreme. But it's something, the last year in the Giro, I'd raced a lot. I didn't stop really between, I did Catalonia, Tour of the Basque Country, Romandy, and then straight to the Giro. So
similar, yeah.
So sort of similar load. So yeah, I think next year, I don't think they're gonna race me into the ground, so to speak. But there's definitely gonna be emphasis on racing instead of training camps and altitude camps, things like that. The normal routes to Grand Tours. I think it's good for me to go into a Grand Tour hot. So, you know what I mean, feeling good, and it gets your morale up. You're in the first week battling it out, and the form's great in the first week. For me, that's more important in a way. I think if you have a few good first stages, that puts you on a real, puts you on the front foot. And I think if you start, you don't know, you're the first little climb, the Grand Tours are like now, they always put something, a bit of a tricky stage in the first few days. So if you're not on 100%, you could lose 30 seconds or whatever. You lose a bit of time on a little hilltop finish, and you're out of the race then. So for me, it's important to avoid that and come in with good form. If that means racing a bit more, then that's what I'll do.
Do you know what Grand Tour or Grand Tours you fancy next year? Has that been discussed yet?
The team this year were pretty cautious with all the COVID stuff, and they didn't really want to have to start changing plans multiple times. So I think they were cautious and then did it as late as possible, given enough time to prepare properly for things, which I think they balance quite well. So I think they're going to try and do something similar to that this year. So, but yeah, it's still early December. I'm in no rush to. I think I'll be starting the season. I think they've told me in the end of February in France, and a couple of the 1 day races at Ardèche, I think it's called. Sorry, and La Drôme Classic or something. Those two, I think I'll start there, and then after that we'll probably have a while break, and then do some of the spring sort of climbers races, Catalonia, Basque Country, those kind of things.
And just finally on you, Hugh, I mean, you said that you always had the potential to do what you did at the Vuelta. Do you dream of winning one of these races? I mean, is that what really sort of gets you out of bed in the morning? Do you think that's within your grasp?
I don't know. I'm not really the most competitive person in the world. I'm not one of those people. It's just winning. You know what I mean? I don't wake up and think, oh, I want to win that. I think now things have changed, perspective's changed a bit. But sort of my biggest dream is just to have a good career where you can look back and think, oh, I had a good career. I did this, whether that's top five in a Grand Tour or winning a Grand Tour, or to some degree, I don't really care. I know it doesn't sound great. Probably my team probably might not want to hit that, but it doesn't mean I'm not going to try to. But I never expect anything of myself, in a way. I never sit there and write a list of things on my bedroom wall and think, oh, I'm going to win this. I want to win this. No, I've never been like that. I don't know. I think things have changed now. The team's going to ask different things of me, more things of me. So I have to adjust my own objectives in line with theirs more now.
But as you say, with Woods and Martinez moving on, there's a sort of opening there, isn't there? At the top of the pecking order in the team.
Yeah, I think the opening would have come at some point. I believe my ability would have. I'd have got the same result regardless. You know what I mean? I think my time, whether it had been next year or whatever the year after, I think it would have come through. I firmly believe it would have come through. It wasn't by luck or by fate that happened. I mean, circumstances allowed me to do it then, but I think sooner rather than later it would have happened.
And just finally, I mean, you've been up riding around where you live, and it's quite a cycling kind of heartland up there. Your performance, the Vuelta, has it sort of elevated your profile a bit? Are you getting recognised more? Are you getting any kind of attention when you're out on the roads?
Yeah, I mean, I've not really seen that many cyclists out, in fairness, because the weather hasn't been great while we've been back. So when I've been out, it's been a bit miserable. I've been out a few times where it's been a fine day and there's been a few people out and they've shouted my name. I didn't know who you were or whatever, but yeah, I'm not going to Sainsbury's and getting bombarded by people.
You're not opening supermarkets yet?
Not yet, no. I don't think I want to.
No.
Not now, anyway.
No.
But no, I don't think, for me, nothing's changed. I still come back here and want to moan to my parents and whinge about what they make for tea or something, or I don't know. No, nothing for me. Nothing's changed. I mean, I still.
You feel the same.
Yeah, I think when you go out and about and your bike, someone shouts your name, it's nice. But 2 seconds later, you realize you've still got the same stuff in your head, thinking, "Oh, I've got to do that later."
Yeah.
I don't get carried away with it or anything.
Well, that was Hugh Carthy, sounding relaxed and pretty happy with his year last year. Looking forward to a big year this year because, as he said, the things have opened up for him a little bit at his team, EF. What are they called now, Lionel? EF Education Nippo.
That's right.
Wow. Danny Martinez left for Ineos, of course. And yeah, there look to be opportunities for him just as he comes into his peak years. Before Christmas, we released an episode with Amara Terra, the Italian band who provide our Giro d'Italia music. Their fundraising has been very successful. There are details in the show notes if you...
Any cycling?
To help.
Chaps, Richard, I'm surprised we've got full episode without you mentioning your own exploits. That's unusual.
Oh, I've been riding my bike a lot. Mountain bike and road bike, and a little bit of indoor biking as well, because the weather's been a bit rainy at times, but it's been great. Lovely. Lionel, you've been riding every day, I think.
I've been doing indoor cycling every day, yeah. I'm trying to complete Zwift. I'm trying to ride every Zwift course. That's my first target for 2020, helping me towards
2021, even.
There we are. I now owe every single listener a hat.
easy mistake to make. Anyway, 2020 was a write-off, so it's understandable. Well, as I say, next week we should be coming to you from Jumbo Visma, all being well. Nothing is guaranteed at the moment, but we certainly hope to be there, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks. So that's all for us for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.